Akira died 2,000 years ago. It's her spirit we're concerned with today. It's found a resting place in somebody.
There's a creepy old house out in the hills, a domicile of weirdness, horror, and thrills, where you never have to wait in line. It's the house of Frankenstein, a strange couple there. Are your hosts? They talk of comics and movies with monsters and ghosts. A peculiar place where the sun doesn't shine. It's the house of Frankenstein.
Hello and welcome to episode 92 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Cindy.
And welcome to our second episode of the House of Frankenstein for 2020. As we hinted last time, we're once again crossing the pond to discuss a film from the only studio that can truly rival Universal in the classic horror output department, Hammer Films. We've got a movie featuring Hammer's biggest stars and two of our favorites here, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. But as you'll see, this film flips the script as far as their casting goes. The Gorgon, I'm not going to say the Gorgon. I've seen people like online say the Gorgon. It sounds like a He-Man villain, so I'm going to say the Gorgon, because that's the way they say it in the movie. So
you're going to pronounce it wrong throughout. No, so nobody send us angry notes.
Well, apparently there's no wrong way to do it, but I just think the Gorgon sounds weird.
The Gorgon.
The Gorgon.
Gorgon.
The Gorgon. Gorgon. The Gorgonzola.
There you go.
The Gorgon was released October 18th, 1964 in the UK and February 17th, 1965 in the US. So that means it came out before Halloween in the UK.
Hey, at least they got it right.
That's right. Directed by Hammer mainstay Terrence Fisher, screenplay by John Gilling, who also directed Hammer films, based on the original story by J. Llewellyn Devine. In the cast, we have Christopher Lee as Professor Carl Meister, Peter Cushing as Dr. Nemiroff, Richard Pascoe as Paul Heitz, Barbara Shelley as Carla Hoffman, Michael Goodliffe as Professor Jewel Heitz, Patrick Troughton as Inspector Canuff, Joseph O'Connor as the coroner, Prudence Hyman as the Gorgon, Jack Watson as Radoff, Redmond Phillips as Hans, Jeremy Longhurst as Bruno Heitz, Tony Gilpin as Sasha Cass, Joyce Hempson as Martha, Alistair Williamson as Janice Cass, and Michael Peake as Constable.
Overshadowing the village of Vandorf stands the castle Borski. From the turn of the century, a monster from an ancient age of history came to live here. No living thing survived, and the specter of death hovered in waiting for her next victim.
On a full moonlit night in a small mill house on the outskirts of Vandorf, Sasha Cass poses partially nude for her fiancé, Bruno Heitz. Sasha breaks down and tells the marriage-shy Bruno they must wed now since she is pregnant with their child. Bruno bolts up and grabs his coat, determined to see Sasha's disapproving father and confirm his obligation to his future wife. Sasha begs him not to go for fear of what her father may do, but he doesn't listen. She soon follows him into the woods, and near the castle Borski finds not Bruno, but something hideous. Sasha screams in terror at the sight and collapses.
The next day at the Vandorf Medical Institution, Inspector Canoff brings Sasha's body to the head of the institution, Dr. Nemiroff. Canoff informs Nemiroff that Sasha's death may be different from the 7 other murders that have plagued Vandorf over the last 5 years. He tells him that the prime suspect, Bruno Heitz, who is missing, is a son of a prominent professor named Jewel Heitz. Nemiroff knows the senior Heitz, the two having attended college together. He suggests the inspector delay informing the professor of what has happened until they find his son.
Nemiroff's assistant and nurse Carla Hoffman wheels Sasha's corpse into the examination room. Sasha's dead arm moves from under the sheet as Carla accidentally bumps into the furniture. Sasha's finger breaks off like a piece of stone from a statue. Carla's shock is interrupted by the mad screams of inmate Martha, who managed to briefly escape from the staff. Namoroff noticed how distressed Carla is and soon sees why. The inspector asks if the doctor will perform an autopsy. Lifting the sheet, Namoroff reveals why he won't.
Doctor, you'll perform an autopsy.
On a body that's turned to stone?
Sometime later, Inspector Kanoff and his men find Bruno hung in the woods from one of the tall trees. An inquest follows, and the testimony of both Inspector Kanoff and Sasha's father paint Bruno as an unruly drunkard capable of violence. Namoroff's time on the stand clinches it when he lies that Sasha died from deep abrasions in the skull. Carla, who knows better, sets in shocked dismay. The final word comes from Bruno's father, Professor Heitz, who decries the testimonies and facts drummed up against his son. He points to the other unsolved murders and accuses the entire town of conspiring to offer his son as a scapegoat. He vows to get to the truth of the matter as the coroner hands down his ruling of a murder-suicide.
Back at the institution, Carla is upset with Namoroff for covering up the truth about the murders, where all the victims turned to stone.
There have been 7 murders committed in the forest of Bandorf in the past 5 years. Every victim bore the same marks. Each body turned to stone. Why didn't you speak of this at the inquest? Why is everyone in Bandorf trying to evade the truth, including you?
Carla.
I expected Kanoff to make a scapegoat of that poor innocent boy. But not you.
Why are you so certain he's innocent?
Because she has come back. She is here. Somewhere. In this hospital, I know it.
Their discussion is interrupted by the arrival of Professor Heitz. He asks Namoroff if he thought his son, whom he had met, was capable of murder. Namoroff offers anyone under the right circumstances could commit murder. Heitz then asks for his former alumni's help in breaking the fearful conspiracy which has branded his son a killer. Namoroff tells him he can offer nothing more than his testimony.
Heitz quizzes the doctor on the legend of Megara, who survived the slaying of her Gorgon sisters and fled to these parts.
Let me ask you one more question. Have you ever heard of Megara?
Megara?
She was one of 3 sisters. They were known as Gorgons. 2 of them were slain. According to the legend, the 3rd, Megara, fled to these parts. It's said that when mortals looked upon her face, they were turned to stone.
That legend is 2,000 years old.
So I believe.
We are men of science. I don't believe in ghosts or evil spirits, and I don't think you do either.
That's one of the most unscientific remarks I have ever heard. I believe in the existence of everything which the human brain is unable to disprove.
Or prove.
That is why I'm remaining in Vandorf.
Heitz tells him he plans to either prove the legend's real or at the very least his son's innocence. Namoroff warns him to leave Vandorf out of fear for the professor. Heitz believes he's only afraid of what he will discover.
Professor Heitz, along with his servant Hans, returns to Bruno's home in Vandorf and begins his research into the local legends. His studies are interrupted by an angry mob who first throw a burning torch into the house and then enter to rough up the professor in an effort to get him to leave. Inspector Kanoff arrives and indirectly runs the mob off. He basically puts a period on the sentence the mob has been writing. The professor is an unwelcome visitor and should leave.
Heitz sends a telegram to Professor Karl Meister at Leipzig University. Meister passes the message along to his assistant Paul, son of Professor Heitz. Paul, who is only aware that his brother is missing, is asked to come to Vandorf at once. The otherwise occupied Meister gives his blessing and well wishes. Professor Heitz will need them. As he studies the legends in the old mill house, he hears the faint sound of a woman singing. This siren call beckons him from the house into the moonlight forest and ultimately to the crumbling Castle Borski. A certain someone must be there. He enters, climbs the stairs, and notices a figure standing behind the large stone columns. A closer look confirms all of his theories are true as he briefly glimpses the snake-haired form of Megara.
A brief glimpse, but enough to send the professor screaming in pain running from the castle. Arriving at the mill house, he calls for Hans, who is startled by his appearance. His skin is ashen gray as if he were slowly turning into stone. With slow, labored speech, he tells Hans he must hurry to write a letter to his son Paul, who is due to arrive tomorrow. He asks Hans to deliver it, but informs him there is nothing he can do for him. Sometime later, with several pages written, his hands grow stiff and petrified.
The next day, Paul takes a meeting with Namoroff concerning his father's death. Namoroff has officially ruled the cause as heart failure, despite the fact that the police will not let him view his father's body. Paul knows better.
Yes, you may see a copy of the death certificate if you wish. But as far as the body is concerned, that is entirely up to the police.
They have refused permission for me to see the body. Why?
This is a police state, Mr. Heist. They don't have to give reasons.
Doctor, did you examine the body?
Of course.
And in your opinion, there was no doubt as to the cause of death. Heart failure.
No doubt whatsoever.
And how do you account for this? I am agonized by pains in my chest. I am turning to stone.
May I see that letter?
I'm sorry. My father gave instructions that I was to show it to no one.
I see.
He knew he was dying when he started to write. He was able to write 3 pages. Now, that doesn't sound like heart failure. You don't go on working through a heart attack. You know that as well as I. He refers to this terrible thing stalking amongst the people of Vandorf. It turns Sasha to stone and others before her. The conspiracy of silence and the fear. And he mentions Megara. Does the name mean anything to you, Dr. Namoroff?
Well, you're not suggesting there's any connection between a character from mythology and your father's death.
When he wrote this letter, he knew what was happening to him. He knew how he was dying and why. It wasn't heart failure.
That is your opinion.
No doubt you'll have an opportunity to express it at the inquest.
When will it be held?
I don't know. But I see that you're informed. Goodbye, Mr. Heitz.
Later, Paul returns home and finds he has an unknown visitor. Carla introduces herself as Dr. Namoroff's assistant. She tells Paul her employer doesn't know of her visit. She warns Paul that Megara is real and her spirit roams the woods and has been known to visit this house. She gives him a friendly warning to leave, but Paul cannot, having lost both his brother and father to this deadly mystery. Carla leaves, but not without igniting a bit of a spark between the two.
Paul later reads the letter aloud while at the institution. Carla recites it from memory, having looked it over while Paul was out of the house. Namoroff listens, but is disappointed she wasn't able to read more. He's certain Heitz, a great scholar of mythology, may have provided a key to solving the mystery of Megara. The lead attendant, Radoff, interrupts and informs the doctor that Martha has escaped again. The doctor warns the angry Radoff that he must bring her back alive. He also confides in Carla that he believes Megara has taken on human form.
That night, under a full moon, a storm rolls in. Paul is looking over his father's notes when a strong wind blows the doors open. He then begins to hear the siren call. The rain begins to pound as he checks the grounds. In the reflecting pool, he sees the hideous reflection of Megara, her snake striking towards him. He runs to the house, but sees her again reflected in the windows. He stumbles back to the pool and collapses.
Days later, he awakens in the institution to the sight of a smiling Carla. Namoroff is examining Martha's corpse when Radoff informs him of Paul's changed condition. The doctor questions his attendant, but Radoff assures him Martha was barely alive when he found her. Namoroff informs Paul that Carla had a suspicion he might be in danger, and they found him unconscious near the pool. He becomes frantic when he describes what he saw to Namoroff, and the doctor tells him he needs complete rest. He hands him a mirror to make his point, and Paul sees his ashen skin and now gray hair. Later, Paul awakens screaming, certain that Megara has been in his room. Carla comforts him, and several days later, when he's ready to leave the hospital, Namoroff makes note of how close his patient and nurse have become.
Learning that both the inquest and his father's funeral have come and gone, Paul asks Namoroff to help him solve the mystery of Megara. Namoroff feigns ignorance of any mystery at all, and Paul assures him that he will unravel it and destroy his tormentor. As shaken, Namoroff calls Radoff into his office and tells him, since it's a full moon, he must not let her out of his sight.
In a nearby cemetery, Paul digs up his father's grave. He removes the coffin lid and shroud to have his suspicions confirmed. His father died of no heart attack. Instead, he was turned to stone. He looks up to see a hooded figure in the shadows. It is Carla, and she finally admits she came to the house to read his father's letter. Paul asks Namoroff is protecting, but she has no answers. She only knows she somewhat fears him, despite the fact that he is in love with her. She admits her love for Paul, and he offers to take her away from Fandor.
Carla, I'll take you away with me now.
I can't leave.
Please don't be afraid of it. I love you.
I love you.
Well, then leave now, Marlowe.
I can't, Paul. I just can't.
But why, if you love me, why not?
I don't know. I don't know why.
Carla.
She runs off, telling him to never ask her again.
Paul later receives a welcome guest, Professor Meister. Meister is startled at his protege's aged looks and listens intently as Paul fills him in on his story.
Well, you propose to keep me standing out here all night?
Professor Meister! Oh, I can't tell you how glad I am to see you.
Good heavens, Paul. What's happened to you?
I've been ill.
Ill? Look as if you've been in your grave and dug your way out.
In his laboratory, Namoroff performs an autopsy, removing Martha's brain from her body. An anxious Carla asks if it was Martha who was Megara in human form, but Namoroff tells her no. He refuses to divulge any theories he has on her true identity until he is certain. Back at the mill house, Meister surmises Paul survived because he only saw Megara's reflection and didn't look directly at her, much like Perseus survived and slayed Medusa by viewing her reflection in his shield. Meister isn't convinced all of what Paul says is true, but he begins to question him about the people he's met, including Carla. He quickly surmises the two are in love.
The next morning, they visit the office of Inspector Canoff, who is none too pleased with Meister's strange request.
Under no circumstances will I permit such a thing. There is no prison.
Don't use long words, Inspector. They don't suit you. Of course, if you don't wish to be of assistance, that's entirely your affair. I shall go higher up.
Higher up?
I presume that even you, Inspector, acknowledge the existence of a superior.
How dare you?
The Foreign Secretary, for example.
I would like to point
out... A very valued friend of my dear brother. But don't bother about it, Inspector. I'll go and see him myself.
It will not...
Yes, you were saying.
It will not be necessary, Professor. It was just that your request startled me for a moment, but... No doubt you have a very good reason. Now, let me see, you wish to inspect the photographs and records.
Of all the women aliens registered here within the last 10 years.
Well, I'll go and get the files.
The inspector quickly changes his tune, and among the now accessible files, Meister finds the registration card for Carla. She first came to Vandorf 7 years ago, and the murders began 5 years ago. Before leaving, Meister warns the inspector he won't tolerate the villagers' rude behavior. Won't tolerate rude behavior, man. Like Professor Heitz did.
Lonesome dub.
Sorry.
I like rude behavior in a man. I won't tolerate it. Paul phones the institution, but Namoroff refuses to speak with him. The doctor then confronts Carla with the knowledge she visited Paul the night before. She begs him to explain why Radoff is constantly shadowing her and why he won't tell her what he is so concerned about. When he refuses, she accuses him of fabricating the whole thing to keep her in submission.
Why are you spying on me?
I'm trying to protect you.
I don't believe you.
I've told you before there are times when you shouldn't be alone.
Tell me about those times. Tell me what happens to me.
I can't yet.
Because it's all an invention.
No.
You're trying to frighten me.
I only want to
frighten
take care
me.
Of you.
So that I'll submit to being treated like a prisoner. I've had enough. I am sick of your jealousy. I am sick of you.
Over the phone, she tells Paul to meet her at the Castle Borski in the morning.
At their rendezvous, Paul finds Carla sitting on a throne on the castle stair landing. She tells him the castle has been abandoned for 50 years, other than Megara still roaming its halls. Paul is surprised to find Carla willing to leave with him, but she insists that they must do it now. When Paul tells her he can't leave immediately due to his work with Meister, she is crestfallen. She runs off, saying she may never see him again.
Leaving the castle grounds, Paul doesn't notice he's being followed by Radoff. Luckily, Professor Meister does and grabs the burly attendant, although he does manage to throw a knife that barely misses Paul and stabs a nearby tree. Radoff runs off, and Paul wonders why Radoff or Namoroff would want him dead. Meister wants answers, and so he breaks into the institution, barely ducking Namoroff, but managing to sneak out with a file folder, while Carla once again leaves unnoticed.
At the mill house, Meister reads the file. Carla came to Van Dorf as a nurse 7 years ago. 5 years ago, she began suffering bouts of amnesia. A year later, after treatments, Nemiroff considered the case closed, but kept her employed as a nurse, which, as Meister points out, is highly irregular. He believes she still suffers those bouts of memory loss every full moon, and that during that time she is possessed by the spirit of Megara. Paul refuses to even consider it, and then they hear Carla scream for him. They run to the terrace to find her in the grip of Radoff, who quickly runs off.
Radoff's good at running off.
Uh-huh.
Paul tells Carla to leave with him that day, but she says she can't. It's too late now, although she cannot explain why. Their conversation is interrupted by the doorbell and Meister informing them they have visitors. Paul takes Carla upstairs, and Meister reluctantly welcomes Nemiroff, Kanoff, and the police force into the house. Nemiroff knows Carla was at the house and demands she be brought to him, or he will press charges of abduction against Paul.
Mr. Heitz, if she's not found, I shall charge you with her abduction.
On what grounds?
I can produce the evidence.
Speaking of evidence, Dr. Nemiroff, perhaps you'd be good enough to return this to Mr. Radoff with my compliments. He left it behind him when he attempted to kill Mr. Heitz yesterday.
What are you insinuating?
I'm not insinuating anything, Doctor. You sent Radoff to follow Carla to the Castle Borski, where she met Paul. When she left, Radoff attempted to kill Paul with this knife. Why do you want Paul out of the way, Nemiroff? Is it because you're afraid he'll take Carla away from you? Or is it because you think he'll find out about the secret that you share with Radoff? Answer me!
How dare you? Take your hands off me.
Professor Meister, you don't release the doctor this instant. I won't hesitate to shoot.
The situation diffuses a bit when Carla isn't found anywhere in the house and the intruders leave.
Paul has sent her to the train station for a trip to Leipzig, but Meister doesn't believe she'll ever make that train. He tells Paul to phone the hotel she's supposed to stay at later in the day to confirm his theory, which Paul still vehemently rejects. Later, Radoff reports to Nemiroff that the police will soon end their search for Carla due to the full moon. He reminds the doctor that the second night of the full moon is when Megara usually appears. An upset Nemiroff sends him away and laments Carla's fate.
That evening, Paul calls the hotel in Leipzig and finds Carla has not arrived, as Meister predicted. Paul continues to ignore Meister's theories and runs off to find Carla. The two scuffle, resulting in Meister slapping Paul and stopping him for his own good.
They must have caught her before she got to the station.
I doubt it. I hope for your sake, Paul, that I'm wrong, but we're looking for the truth.
But the fact that she hasn't arrived proves nothing.
Nothing at all. But do we discard my theory simply because it upsets your scheme of things, or do we go on looking for the truth?
Well, she's out there somewhere. I'm going to look for her.
Wait, Paul! In an hour's time, it'll be dark. Wait until the morning. Paul, you won't find Carla! Get out of my way! I am sorry, Paul, but I can't let you destroy yourself.
Paul sulks in his bedroom until Meister nods off, and then he escapes through the upstairs window. As he sneaks off the property, Kanoff and his men arrive. They have a warrant for Paul's arrest, charging him with Carla's abduction. When Meister finds him missing, Kanoff intends to take the professor in, but he has other plans. He shoves the officers over and runs upstairs and out the same escape window while Paul makes his way to the castle.
There, he calls for Carla, but instead finds Nemiroff laying in wait with a sword. Paul grabs a large candelabra and the two begin dueling, fighting throughout the castle foyer. Locked in battle, the two never notice the figure of Megara watching intently from the landing. The battle takes them to the top of the stairs where Nemiroff gets the advantage and throws his opponent down them. He then notices someone observing their fight and turns to briefly glimpse the Gorgon. He shields his eyes and grabs for his sword. He climbs the stairs toward her, his hand covering his face. But as he draws nearer and swings, he is forced to look, and in that moment, he is doomed. His swing misses and he falls backward, his skin already becoming pitted and gray as he stumbles down the stairs, pulling a hanging banner down around him.
Paul comes to and walks to the body of his fallen opponent beneath the large mirror. There, he once more sees Megara's reflection and turns away as the Gorgon glides down the stairs towards him. Professor Meister enters the castle from a different entrance, unseen. Megara uses her will to force Paul to turn towards her as Meister sneaks up behind her, picking up Nemiroff's sword. Paul looks directly at the red eyes and snake crown and drops in silent agony. While Meister swings, with one blow, Megara's head goes flying down the stairs, coming to a rolling stop at their base.
As a weary Meister rests against the banister, the dying Paul crawls over to Megara's severed head. After the snakes recoil into the skull, he watches her serpentine skin melt away, revealing the face of the woman he loved. With the last breath of his petrifying lungs, he calls her name, as his mentor and friend assures him of her newfound peace.
She's free now, Paul. She's free.
Oh boy. Okay.
A lot to unpack there.
Yeah. It's only 84 minutes, but there's a lot in this movie. Yeah. We start out with a great score by James Bernard, as usual, who's, you know, he's Hammer's, other people did Hammer music, but he did all the classics. He did Dracula, Frankenstein, etc. At the end of the credits, we get a crawl establishing the village, the castle, and the monster. That's what we read at the beginning. Now that's economic storytelling, you know, I mean, it's got, you know, it's kind of like Star Wars, but, you know, so... You know, the bit with Sasha and Bruno could have almost come before the titles, like as a cold open, a la James Bond film. You know? And other Hammer movies did do that later on. They do the cold open, and then they go into the credits, like Twins of Evil did, and I think Vampire Circus, some of their later 70s films. You know, these characters' actions drive the plot, but we never really see them again. Except for one brief appearance of Bruno as a hanged corpse.
Yeah.
So, well, I guess we see Sasha, but she's petrified.
Yeah.
Tony Gilpin, who plays Sasha, will also appear as the Pharaoh's wife in Hammer's The Mummy Shroud in 1967. There's a lot of, just, you know, as always, there's a lot of multiple Hammer appearances from these actors here. Mm-hmm. Now, later on, the judge calls Bruno her fiancé, but I wonder just how official that was. I wonder if, do you think they just threw that in to save her family name just a bit?
Oh, yeah, they were just, you know, doing the deed.
And they just said, oh, that was her fiancé, so it was a little less scandalous.
Right.
Yeah, even though he, you know, murdered her, apparently, by official ruling, he murdered her, so... we meet Peter Cushing, and of course he's fiddling with props, because Cushing is always determined to sell you on the role he's playing, and he always does.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's, you know, they call him Props Cushing for a reason. So, we featured Peter Cushing on every House of Frankenstein, so no need to go into his legendary filmography here. Needless to say, he and Lee are icons of the genre, so, you know, and we'll get into Lee as well, but they're Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, so... another icon is Patrick Troughton, playing the rather ineffective inspector here, but he was much more effective as the second Doctor on Doctor Who from 1966 to 1969. He also appeared in several other Hammer films, such as Scars of Dracula with Lee and Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell with Cushing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, for some reason I love his handlebar mustache in this. It makes it look like his teeth are coming right out of it.
Well, I mean... speaking of facial hair, there is something about Cushing's facial hair in this that just disturbed me.
Yeah.
I think it was the mutton choppy part of it.
It's basically got like a mutton chops that swoop down and then become a mustache.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
There's not any actual beard.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, it's kind of interesting. Although Peter, you know, Christopher Lee's obviously got a mustache too, but, you know... you give Peter Cushing a semi-beard and he's evil. You know, he's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Although, honestly, you can say he's less evil than Frankenstein, Baron Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah.
He's always clean-shaven.
Yeah.
So, but... yeah.
I don't know. I was not a fan of this look.
What about Christopher Lee's bushy mustache?
No. That was, like, put on with glue. Not the facial hair game was not strong in this movie.
Well, there's another hair thing in this that we'll get to that I thought was kind of weird.
I said facial hair.
Okay. All right.
So.
Well, no, I'm not. It's not the one you think I'm thinking about. But so it sure seems like Namoroff is in charge of the police here, because he tells the inspector to hold off contacting Bruno's father, and he never questions it.
Mm-mm.
So I get the impression that every time... you know, Kanoff's the type that's like, oh crap, what am I supposed to do with that? Somebody else turned to stone, and Namoroff's like, I'll take care of it. Just, and so he's really, you know, pulling strings with the with the police department. Yeah. I do like how Cushing reacts as soon as Kanoff says Bruno's name is Heights. We later learn he had met Bruno before, so it's a great bit of a lot of actors would have not bothered with. He just has this reaction, like when he says that, he's like, wait a minute, I know that name. You know, that's, you know, it's subtle, but, you know, if you watch, you know, and I, you know, tend to like really pay attention to Peter Cushing in movies because I've seen so many now, but. Barbara Shelley is another Hammer all-star, and with 7 films for the studio, she emerges as perhaps their most reliable female star. Among those many films were Rasputin the Mad Monk with Lee and Dracula Prince of Darkness, also with Lee, of course, where she gets to play a fussy, button-down lady who becomes a rather lustful vampire after Drac puts his fangs in her. Yeah, and there's that famous scene where she's staked by a group of monks, you know, Father Sandor. But that's a good one. We need to do that. 1 year. That's a good one. The sting with the finger breaking off. Now, that's just really well done. And then you follow it up with Martha, the mental patient screaming. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, you don't even get, Barbara Shelley barely gets time to, like have a visual reaction when Martha screams off screen.
Right.
You know, it's really well done. It creates this sense of impending dread. It's much like Renfield and the inmates and Dracula reacting to his presence. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the idea that she's, of course, Martha's kind of a red herring too, or maybe a red garter snake. I don't know, but you know, so when Carla first appears, she walks into the examination room and she lovingly stares at Namorov, who is too busy to notice. So you could imagine it's a one-sided relationship or attraction, like she's attracted to him, but he's too busy to ever notice her.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll soon find out it's kind of the other way around.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think she's fond of him because at this point she feels like he's helped her.
Well, it's almost like a Stockholm thing.
Yeah.
She feels like she owes him her allegiance.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, he cradles her when she says, you know, when she's frightened by the finger breaking off. So you quickly figure out that he is definitely mm-hmm. has romantic feelings for her. So the corpse of Bruno hanging in the tree is a bit of a shocker. But I've often wondered, why did he hang himself? Mm-hmm. Did he hang himself?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, do we think he made it to Sasha's father's house, and he knows about the pregnancy. The father knows about the pregnancy at the trial. So did he know about it before, or did Bruno go to the father's house? They never say that.
You don't want to know my take on the whole situation?
What?
I think he made it to the father's house, and then the dad and some buddies of him strung him up.
Hmm.
Took justice into their own hands.
Hmm. Well, it could be, or, you know, I just don't understand. If he's in hiding, how did he even find out that Sasha was dead? You know, unless he come upon her petrified body before they did and ran off and then hung himself.
I don't know. That's the way I look.
And, I mean, honestly, you could look at, I mean, with what he has Radoff try to do later, you can almost imagine that Radoff killed him and then hung him to
throw everybody off
and to say, oh, well, here's your, you know, scapegoat.
Your killer, yeah.
We'll get into that later, but, you know, it's definitely a short-term solution because the real killer's out there and going to kill again, but which is kind of strange. I do have to wonder, though, why there's blood on his forehead. I mean, is that from birds, like, pecking at him or something, you know?
I took it that they had roughed him up, you know. The Sasha's father and some buddies roughed him up because what he did to a village girl. Because he was seen as an outsider,
He rented the house like once a year, mm-hmm. and he was a bohemian. The inquest is an interesting scene. The actors do a fine job of conveying everyone is just ready to blame everything on Bruno.
Mm-hmm.
Cushing's false testimony is particularly well done. He coughs as he takes the stand, and he drinks a glass of water as he finishes it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's you know, he still projects that super professional, but it's like, it's also, you know, I wonder if that was a Peter Cushing's idea to do that, to kind of, you know, considering it's a totally different testimony than what we saw last year in in Frankenstein Created Woman, where he has that great, you know, where he's like, I am a doctor of medicine, blah, 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 in witchcraft. I do not, they don't offer degrees in witchcraft, but if they did, I would certainly, you know, have one. You know, it's like, you know, where he's thumbing through the Bible, kind of like, oh, what's this? You know, just so. Here we meet Professor Jewel Heights, played by Michael Goodliffe, who had appeared with Barbara Shelley in her first Hammer movie, Camp on Blood Island. He would go on to appear uncredited in the James Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun, of course starring Christopher Lee as the villain. He also played the uncredited role of Mike TV's father in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. So, there you go. Now, speaking of facial, you said facial hair, but his hair, Jewel Heights' hair, always bothered me. Is that a wig? It looks like he has a stuffed porcupine on his head.
Oh, yeah, that's it's gotta be. There's no way.
And his hair looks much different later on, too, which is very odd. Mm-hmm. When he is petrified, he's got like, you know, it looks like they took his wig off and he's got like a receding hairline and like a Caesar cut almost. Mm-hmm. So it's like, why did they do that? Why did they give him such weird looking hair? Yeah. They weren't on their hair game in this movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Also, this coroner, I mean, you know, I don't know what European country we're supposed to be in, but he sure seems like a judge to me, but he's listed as a coroner.
Well, it's cause of death.
That's the inquest of the cause of death.
Mm-hmm. So that's what, because they're not.
It's not a criminal trial.
They're not assigning blame and consequences, because the consequences have already happened. Who they think is at fault, they're just assigning cause of death.
Okay. Joseph O'Connor, who was a coroner, was in Hammer's Swashbuckler, The Bloodship Pirates, and was also the narrator of The Dark Crystal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Carla almost speaks to Professor Heights as they're getting up to leave the courtroom, or whatever you call it, but Namoroff stops her.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. So she's probably going to offer her condolences, and he, like, basically steers her away. And when she confronts him about his false testimony, you can see Carla is starting to see Namoroff in a different light now. It's like, okay, I never thought she'd do this. Mm-hmm. Namoroff asks, how does she know Bruno was innocent? Well, what did you think he did do? Just, did he pour plaster all over her?
Right. I mean, it just...
That was kind of a silly thing for him to, you know, say to her. I mean, I know he's an artist, but, you know, she was solid stone. She wasn't just covered in plaster, right. You know, so... And really, and Kanoff and Namoroff are quick to pin this on Bruno, but like I said, to what end? Because, you know, chances are the next time the full moon rolls around, Megara is going to kill again and turn somebody else to stone. So, you know, their implied story about Bruno will be kaput by then. But I guess, you know...
Anything that can throw him off the scent that Numeroff is thinking is happening, you know, he's all for.
I guess. Cushing lights a cigarette, then puts it in a holder while he's talking with Heights. It shows he's very dismissive of whatever he has to say, but that's apparently also the way that Cushing liked to smoke, although he often wore gloves so he wouldn't get nicotine stains on his fingers, which then showed up on film. So he was a very discreet smoker because he didn't want it to, you know, affect his acting. So we learn our Gorgon is Megara. But apparently, the legendary Megara wasn't a Gorgon. Now, this is from IMDb. I did not go and research this any further, so if it's wrong, I apologize. But I took enough notes on this movie anyway.
Uh-huh.
The name of the Gorgon's character is Megara, supposedly taken from mythology. But Megara, which means jealous in Latin, I guess, in ancient myth is one of the three Erinyes, or Furies. I like the word Fury. The goddesses of revenge, not a Gorgon. According to Hesold, the three Gorgons were Snethno, Uriel, and Medusa. So Medusa's two sisters were Snethno and Uriel. And that's probably just, you know, everybody knows Medusa.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's seen Clash of the Titans, they know Medusa. So
well, there you go.
We later learn Medusa's fate from legend in Clash of Titans is kept intact in this film, so I guess that's why we didn't go with the more obvious Medusa for the name of it. Yeah, although Megara is also the name of the love interest in Disney's Hercules.
True.
Yeah. Namoroff warns Heights to leave. Do you think he was actively involved in the townspeople trying to run him off?
I don't think he was actively involved. He probably encouraged it, though.
What about Caniff, Inspector?
He was working on the suggestion of Nemiroff and took it and run with it.
Because, you know, when he comes to the door, he doesn't try to arrest anybody. He literally walks past the people who just threw a flaming torch through a dude's window and then come in and roughed him up, like started to beat him up. And the only reason they run off is like, oh, it's the cops, basically, and they run off. But they don't run off real super. They're not real discreet about running off. They run past him, which goes to tell me it's like, you know, it's almost like, okay, you guys go rough him up some, and I'm going to come in and break it up. You know, almost like he really orchestrated it. So, of course, we've seen angry mobs before in classic monster movies. They're staples of horror films, but they're usually after an actual monster.
Right.
Yeah, here they're just, you know, they're attempting to burn a man out of his home, which is, you know, well, his rental home anyway, but still, it's like, geez. 20 minutes in, and we meet our top build star, Christopher Lee, and his bad mustache, apparently. But only briefly. I know you were asking, where's Christopher Lee here in a bit? You're like, where's he at?
I know. I'm like, dude.
He only shows up for a minute, and he's like examining this, looks like an Egyptian head of
some artifact,
kind.
Yeah.
And he's like, I give your father my regards, and I hope everything's all right. You know, and he's like, you know, it's like, he's like, he's totally involved the whole time. He never hardly even looks up. He's like, here's a telegraph, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, but it just shows, you know, how it establishes that this guy is the brains here. But, I don't think we need to go over Christopher Lee's career. As I said, needless to say, he made his name in Hammer, mostly off his portrayals of the Frankenstein monster, the mummy, and of course, most importantly, Dracula, all opposite Peter Cushing. But it actually had been over 4 years since these two best friends had made a film together. So this was kind of a reunion for him of sorts. And they'd go through different periods where they'd make movies together and then they wouldn't for a few years, but there's quite a few, you know, Lee Cushing movies. Lee is, of course, playing older than his actual age with the gray hair and that big bushy mustache you don't like. But now Paul is played by Richard Pascoe, who had appeared in Hammer's Robin Hood film Sword of Sherwood Forest with Peter Cushing and later with Christopher Lee in Rasputin the Mad Monk. He was also in Disney's Watcher in the Woods, which I really hope is on Disney Plus this Halloween season.
Hey, I've offered to buy that movie for you I don't know how many times.
Well, I saw it at Target last year. But it was right before Disney Plus was getting ready to launch. And I'm like, oh, it'll be on Disney Plus. It wasn't.
Told you.
And I never saw it again. So I just assume that Paul is some sort of assistant to Meister. They never state it, but it seems that way. Is that what you got out of it?
I would say like he was a teaching assistant or something of that nature.
He seems too old to be a traditional student. I mean, he's younger than Christopher Lee's playing, but...
Yeah.
You know, I always thought Richard Pascoe looks a bit like Richard Thomas that played John Boy on The Waltons. There's something about him in this movie that looks like him. Hammer likes to use the same or similar sounding names over and over in their films. Lots of Pauls. There's a Paul in Curse of Frankenstein. Lots of Hans. There's Hans in Frankenstein Created Woman and other Hammer movies. We have Meister here, where we had Baron Meister with an N in the middle in Brides of Dracula, etc. So I don't know. They just kept reusing the same names or slight variations of names over and over in Hammer movies. So, but when you hear a ghostly siren call, don't answer it. Don't answer any siren call, not even in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? They'll love you up like a toad.
Turn you into a horny toad.
That's right. You can scream like... Oh! I love that movie. I like how Professor Heitz's walk through the garden establishes the reflecting pool, the stairs, etc., that will play into the plot later. So that was nice setup. So Terrence Fisher is once again giving us one of his adult fairy tales. The castle looks like something Disney abandoned. The dried leaves blowing around are a wonderful touch, and they give the film that Halloween vibe that is just perfect for a film like this, especially this time of year.
Right.
Now, Bernard Robinson's set design never fails to amaze and became a part of the film nearly as important as the cast, just like in every other Hammer film he worked on. On a limited budget, he totally sells this crumbling castle and the mill house and the courtroom and the institution. he is one of Hammer's secret weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, he makes these movies look like several million bucks when they probably only cost like a million.
Yeah.
If that. So, we only get a very brief glimpse of Megara here, and the look is totally effective at this point. I think the film would have worked even better if this was the most we ever saw of her.
Right.
But, you know, we'll get into that later. But I love how she recedes into the background when he leaves. It's like, you know, she comes out, he just sees her through the columns, but he gets a glimpse of her, and then it shows him running off, and then it just, like, a long shot, and she just kind of, like, melds back into the shadows as he leaves.
I don't know. Anytime I see something like that, I keep thinking of Homer Simpson going back into the hedgerow every time. Goes in, I can't help it. I see somebody do that, and I'm like, oh, you know.
You have to wonder, though, why does she want to turn everyone to stone? Is it revenge for humankind destroying her sisters? She doesn't drink blood like a vampire to survive. She doesn't have this instinct to hunt like a werewolf. She's not controlled like the mummy usually is by somebody. She just likes killing people,
mm-hmm.
I guess. Or she's got, you know, she just got revenge in mind. It's just her, that's her gig, you know. I mean, So I really love the makeup they use on Heitz's face and hands. It's not overdone, but it does look like someone turning to stone. And Goodliff sells how painful it is to breathe and talk and move. But I do have a few questions. One, what is with the little pitted holes in the forehead?
I don't know. I wondered that too.
Because Cushing's got them later. Mm-hmm. Sasha had them.
Yeah.
It's almost as if like the snakes like came out and bit them, but you know they didn't.
Yeah,
of course.
I know.
You didn't see that, and they didn't. But, you know, again, in his porcupine hair, that's another question. Why did it suddenly become a brushed down Caesar cut?
I
don't either. But most importantly, and it's one we both thought of while we were watching this and actually mentioned it, which we usually try not to mention things that we're going to say on the podcast, but some things are just like, what? Why did he dictate the letter to Hans?
I know. He could have got a lot more written out if he was writing it, had somebody else write it for him.
What's happened, sir?
For God's sake, don't come near.
Your face.
Listen carefully. I haven't much time, Hans. I have to write a letter to my son, Paul. He should be here tomorrow. In the morning. Take the letter and give it to him. No one else must see it but Paul. You understand?
Yes, sir.
Leave me now. There is nothing you can do. Goodbye, Hans.
Yeah, and how can Hans go back to bed knowing his master is turning to stone downstairs?
Yeah!
You know, it's like, okay, man, I'll leave you till you're petrifying. I'm really beat.
I'm going to let you go die on your own.
Yeah,
you know?
I was cleaning the house all day. It's a wreck. And so I'm tired. I'm going to bed. Like, you can turn stone on your own. I mean, it's just... Now, that's a butler who follows the proper manservant code, though. He tells him, so you can do nothing for me, so go on, you know. But, yeah, why didn't he just dictate him the letter? When Paul...
Well, the only thing is, possibly he was illiterate. So, at that time, I happened to think about that. He might not have been able to write.
He could. That's true. Yeah, that's true. When Paul produces the letter, Namroff wants to see it. Do you think he was going to yell, yoink, and then run out of the office?
You could just see him go, come on, yeah. See it.
Let me see that letter. No, really, I really want to see that letter. It's like, yoink! That's just like see Peter Cushing. It's like, take off running, start playing the music from Horror Dracula.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the music from Benny Hill.
Then they're running out of the hospital room.
Like Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
Okay, it's getting late.
All of a sudden, Barbara Shelley's running around in her underwear. You know, it's like... It's a Hammer movie. At this point, wouldn't it be smarter for them to just go along with the legend and try to scare Paul off? I mean, why keep denying everything? Denying it wholesale only puts the blame of conspiracy on Namroff and the police, but I guess if you just keep lying, you can never stop even if to tell a half-truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it would have made a whole lot more sense. Oh, yes, Megara's real. you should leave town immediately. You know, it's just like, you know, and we've tried to destroy her and we can't, you know, or something like that. Pasco and Cushing have a well-developed instant animosity between them here, and it's only going to get worse when romance gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have read that this film has a relaxed style, and many of Hammer's films of this period do. They take time to establish mood and atmosphere, and they give you a chance to soak up all the environments, such as the case when Paul comes to the mill house and walks about. But this sets up what's going to happen to him later as well, just like his father did. Now we're seeing it again. It's like, you know, the third time we're going to get you with it, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. So what did you think of Carla's red hooded fur lined cloak? Did that remind you of a certain Disney princess?
And she was in a castle. She yeah. just needed to be in a library. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Looked a little like Belle's Christmas outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah. We later.
I love you.
Yeah. Well, I know these things. We later learn Carla went there under Namoroff's orders to read and memorize the letter, but I wonder if she was supposed to divulge as much as she did about the legend.
Yeah.
Because she goes into a lot of detail there. Mm-hmm. I wonder if she was like, okay, I came here to do this, but I'm giving you the pitch, dude. You need to leave. But you're kind of hot. That's basically what she said.
Herbert Spencer once said that every legend and myth known to mankind is not entirely without its authentic foundation. Presupposing he is right, we must go to the very source of this legend, to a time over 2,000 years ago, to ancient Greece.
There were three hideous monsters, sisters. They were called Gorgons. Their names were Tisiphone, Medusa, and Megara. Their heads were crowned with living snakes, and each snake was a tentacle of the hellish brain from which it sprang. So hideous was the Gorgon that anyone who looked upon her was petrified. The proper word is Gorgonized, which literally means turned to stone.
Go on.
I'm sorry. He came in just then. That's all I had time to memorize.
So what did you think when you found out she was sent there to spy on him? Were you surprised?
No.
Oh, okay. Because you had seen this, you realized after you started watching it that you had seen this movie before.
Right.
Which I was pretty sure you had. Because well, like I said, I don't want to pull a movie on you that you haven't seen before. After Dr. Fibes.
I love you.
Yeah.
I love you so much. But that was one of those things that if things ever go south between us, that's going to be one of the things that's written in the...
He made me watch The Abominable Dr. Fibes.
Uh-huh.
That was abominable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Namoroff goes in for an embrace, and Carla backs away. Knowing what he knows, or at least suspects of her, it's kind of surprising he would be that into her.
Well, she's hot.
So, I mean, you know, and guys Barbara are dumb. Shelley is very, very beautiful, but at the same time, it's like...
Guys are dumb.
I guess, but, you know...
I mean, look at the other women in the village. He was going for the hot piece, you know? Yeah.
I actually never see any other women in the village other than Martha, but, you know.
And Sasha.
Oh, and Sasha, yeah. Yeah. Radoff, we meet Radoff here, and he's the kind of guy you hear about on those nursing home exposés on the, you know, on the,
oh,
the
yeah.
news magazine shows. It's, unfortunately, yeesh, I mean, whew. So they are starting to drop more hints that Martha may be the Gorgon. But I never mm-hmm. once thought that.
I thought there was something else going on there.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe she was her servant and, you know, or something. I, you know, but I never thought she was the person.
They don't try too hard to build a case for it. Just that she is constantly escaping and mad. But it's like, she's, I don't even know if I'd call her a red herring. She's like, I mean, just, I don't know if anybody would ever be convinced. She's more of a... And we'll get into it, but she's more of a character that they can, that the characters can put the blame on. You know, that it's somebody for basically Carla, Barbara Shelley's character, to say, well, maybe it's Martha. Maybe it's not me. You know, right. We'll get into that. But, yeah. The burn about a monster that depends on the lunar cycle is that you only get 3 nights a month and only one true full moon night. So Megara had to agree to a second show to get Paul in, or he'd have to wait a month. So he basically got his dad one night and Paul the next. Yeah. I mean, it's like back-to-back nights. So she had to, you know, she, you know, had to stay for a second showing. That basically held over. the reflection of Megara with the snake striking actually works here. I mean, that's actually pretty cool when it's reflected in the water.
Yeah.
That, and it's like up above. So the last thing Paul saw was Megara. And now the first thing he sees when he comes back to consciousness is Carla. So do we think Radoff killed Martha?
Oh, yeah. Or he didn't save her either, you know.
Yeah.
He might have come upon her and she had hurt herself and he's just laying up, standing over top of her going, yeah, you die, woman.
And she spit on him, apparently, yeah. And then bled out or something. You never know what she died of, exactly. Yeah. Based on what we see later, it's entirely possible. And she clearly wasn't Gorgonized, so, which I love how they use that, you know, it's Gorgonized. That's a verb.
Mm-hmm.
Paul looks a bit ashen and gray-haired, but it's kind of hard to tell in the first scene in bed.
Right. I was like, what are we looking at, you know, at first when he's like, well, see for yourself. And I'm like, what are we seeing?
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's the lighting's too dark in there, and Something. He's real sweaty looking. Mm. So that's part of it, too. We definitely have a Florence Nightingale syndrome thing with Paul and Carla here. So, you know, but.
Or it's kind of weird because I was thinking Marty McFly and his mom.
Oh, ooh. Well, she's about the same age as him, not the same age as his father.
I know, but I, you know.
Yeah. I love that is so weird. I love Cushing's double take as he watches them touch hands when Paul enters for his exit interview. They both have their hands on the doorknob and they kind of touch hands, and and Peter Cushing goes, "What?"
Like, she's mine.
Again, why is Namoroff playing so stubborn about this? Wouldn't it make more sense to agree there's something going on and lead him away from it than have him be a free agent?
I know.
You know,
I
it's
know.
Just, it's like, dude, you're playing the wrong game here, man. It's like, you're not, I think he's just so smug and arrogant. He just doesn't, you're meddling in my affairs. Go away.
Yeah.
You know. The conversation with Radoff pretty much drops any pretense of Megara being anyone else but Carla?
Yes, sir. There's a full moon tonight. Don't let her out of your sight.
I feel I have the right to ask you a question.
What is it?
Is she in danger?
She may be close to death.
My one gripe with this film is they could have had a few more female characters.
Right.
And at least threw a few more red herrings in, but then they would have had to develop them more, so I'm not sure it would have been worth it.
Right. I mean, this is a tight film, and I don't know if the, you know, with the timing and everything else, they wanted to keep it under 90 minutes, so.
I mean, they barely do anything with Martha.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
You know, but. Jack Watson, who plays Radoff, made a career out of playing rugged types in movies like The Devil's Brigade and the infamous Peeping Tom, which made Hammer's efforts of the time seem tame by British censor comparisons. That movie got everybody up in an uproar, so. We cut to Professor Heitz's grave, and we see the wreath that was mentioned in the previous scene. Carla sent it in Paul's stead. All things are pointing to Carla. Mm-hmm. Carla, there's a neon sign pointing at Castle Borski. Carla lives here at least once a month. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Carla does seem to have some subconscious idea that something isn't right. She wants to leave Namoroff, but she can't. She wants to leave with Paul, but she can't. But she can't explain why. So it's like there's something in the back of her head. And maybe it's something she won't fully admit to herself. But we later learn she does suffer from amnesia.
Well, I almost wonder if Namoroff didn't hypnotize her into, you know, she can't remember.
Mm.
And, you know, kind of like a whole, you know, where Professor Xavier hypnotized Jean so that her bad side didn't come out.
Basically, he put a cap on her powers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder, you know, if there's something going on like that there.
Hmm. Could be. Yeah.
Just a thought.
Hmm. Oh, Peter Cushing as Professor X. Man, that would have worked. Anyway.
See?
Yeah. Well, oddly enough, I've still never seen it, but James McAvoy played Victor Frankenstein.
Oh, that's right.
In that film
that's
with
right.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, so. Igor?
He played Igor.
Igor.
Igor's in Young Frankenstein. Oh. We'll get to Igor later.
Shh, don't tell them.
Okay, sorry. Well, they heard the trailer. It's kind of hard to not know who that is. Mm. He's mine. You go away. You know, so, but anyway. Christopher Lee gets a dramatic entrance silhouetted in the shadows with the wind whipping around him. It's not as impressive as his first Dracula intro, but it's very befitting for him either way.
Right.
I thought it's cool. I love Lee's line about Paul looking like you dug out of your own grave. He ought to know, but that's a great line. You look like you dug out of your own grave.
However, if he's Dracula, how would he know? Because he can't see. Just saying.
His reflection.
Yeah. Just mention. Sorry.
That's true. I bet Cushing had a cabbage off camera to cut into when he's doing the autopsy on Martha because, you know, he would ask doctors he knew, well, what would I need to use to make this, to make it look right, like I'm really cutting into something or to make the sound and this mm-hmm. and that. And it's a shame he never got to play like in a medical drama, like as a surgeon, because there were probably very few actors that like had at least the convincing precision of a surgeon that Peter Cushing did.
Right.
All the different times he cut somebody up in his movies.
Yeah.
Brains removed and things. Yeah. Yeah. I like how Meister picks up on Paul's love for Carla instantly. You really get the idea that him and Paul are an old team of friends. Like he's his mentor. Their mentor and protege. That's good writing, good direction, and it's just great acting, mm-hmm. honestly. And it's in a very few short minutes, you get the idea. And Paul's very relieved to see his friend. And who wouldn't be, you know? I mean, after what he went through and losing his brother and his father. I love the scene in Kanoff's office. Lee comes into this movie and takes it over like a boss with only a half an hour left. And poor Kanoff starts backpedaling immediately when Meister name drops that his brother is chummy with the foreign secretary.
Yeah.
that won't be necessary. Don't you speak words, Inspector. That doesn't suit you, you know. That closing line of tell your villagers not to start something with me is also great. I mean, the cool thing about it is, unlike many actors, we now know that Lee, who worked for British intelligence in World War II, was fully capable of doing all sorts of nasty and deadly things to those who deserved it, and it adds a layer of reality and verisimilitude to his bravado because he can literally back it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know? So Carla finally confronts Namroff, and we learn Radoff has been following her around for quite some time. She accuses him of making it all up and gaslighting her. But I get in Shelley's performance, she is again trying to convince herself she's not Megara when she knows she probably is. Do you get that at this point that she thinks...
She's like, yeah, she's... I do.
I get at this point she's... She knows she's connected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she knows the extent, but she's trying to convince herself that she's not. At least a part of her does. I don't know if she's even capable of fully realizing it, you know, lest she literally go mad. But then we get Carla sitting on that throne.
Right.
So
she's like, you know.
Are her two personalities starting to coalesce just a bit?
Right.
You know, she has a changed demeanor very briefly in those few moments, too. Mm-hmm. She's very regal. Then she turns to the idea that they can now escape because, you know, I guess then the real Carla feels that she's free of Namroff now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely, you get the impression there's a lot of conflict inside Carla, you know, and it's not just in the I can't go with you today, but I can go with you now. I can't go with you last night, but I can go with you now. It's not just that. It's more, there's more nuanced performance there from Barbara Shelley that you can pick up on and you can interpret it how you want. But I tend to think that there's definitely a dominance issue. Like there's times that she's starting to kind of feel like she is Megara, and other times she's like, no, I'm not. I'm fine. We can go, you know, and mm-hmm. things like that. So, So now Redoff is going to straight up murder Paul. You know, is like, do you think he went to this level on his own, or did Namroff tell him to do it?
I think that was one of those cases. He's like, scare him off, and Redoff's all like, I'll take care of him. I'll scare him off.
Or what if he says, take care of it? Yeah. And he's like, basically like, I don't want to know how, just take care of it.
Yeah.
You know. And to Namroff, it's like, well, if he kills him, he kills him. If he roughs him up and throws him on the next train, you know, and,
right.
and beat the hell up, then that's fine, too, as long as he's just out of town. So, yeah, but it does make you wonder about Martha again. I'm impressed Christopher Lee can get those long legs through that tiny window.
I know. It made me think about trying to see, like, Andrew go through something like that. Because, you know, our son's 6'4", and I'd like to see... You know, remember when he test drove that car that time?
Yeah.
That was ridiculous.
He looked like that guy on The Simpsons that gets out of the car. Yeah, just like
that. I mean, his knees were up at his ears when he was driving that car, and that makes me think of the same thing that, you know, as Lee goes out the window.
Yeah, yeah, he climbs in the window at the institution and later goes out the window. And then when he goes out the window, he kind of grabs his leg.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's a lot of leg to get through that window. I love the scene, though, when he breaks in, because you see Namroff through the windows of the office, and Meister has to hide flush against the wall, while Bernard's moody score does all the audio work, since there is no dialogue, and it's got this really, there's this, like, woodwind, like, low woodwind sound going through it. It's really well done. And Namroff almost catches him, and we almost get our first scene with Lee and Cushing together. But then they pull back, and that's a great bit of tension. It's like, not only is it going to get caught, ooh, we're about to get a Lee Cushing scene.
Yeah.
It's like, nope, no, we're not. Then Radoff enters the scene briefly, and Carla sneaks out. All the characters are just missing each other. It is kind of like the Benny Hill thing, but just in slow motion.
Or Scooby-Doo,
yeah. It's like a crazy stage play. It's like noises off or something,
mm-hmm.
You know. So Meister has it all figured out, but Paul refuses to believe it. Would you believe it?
I mean, come on, you know?
But, I mean, he knows that his father... I mean, he knows his father was turned to stone. He knows that he knows what he saw. So, he knows Megara's real. So, I mean, I know he's in love with Carla, but at the same time, it's just really unfortunate that he really doesn't listen to Meister, obviously. It doesn't work out for him, as we know. But, now, here's something that I thought about while doing these notes. You have to wonder... Why doesn't Namroff just lock her up? I mean, he's running an asylum, an institution and an asylum. I know he's in love with her, but she goes out once a month and becomes this thing that kills people. Why not just say, you have amnesia once a month, so we're going to sedate you and keep you under observation 3 nights a month and keep her from killing people?
I don't know.
Had you thought of that before?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like... It's like in these
like whole, you know, when you chain the werewolf up.
Exactly. It's like, you know, I mean, that's one thing I know I'm going to bring up Dark Shadows, but which I watched, by the way, guys, I watched all of Dark Shadows from when Barnabas showed up to the end. I haven't watched all of the pre-Barnabas episodes yet. I'll be honest, I got kind of bored with them because they're not horror, you know, and they're not even particularly spooky, honestly. I don't even understand what's all that gothic about the early Dark Shadows, really. But I might get back to one of these days. But I did go through all that. But what I was going to say, on there, the werewolf Chris Jennings and Quentin, they would say, you know, they would say, it's gonna be the full moon. Lock me up, you
right.
know. And they would lock them up. Now, usually something would happen that they'd get loose. But they would lock them up every time the full moon came along. This guy's got an institution. He's got inmates that are locked up like Martha. He's got straitjackets. Lock her up. So Carla could leave yesterday, but not today. So if she was away from Vandorf in the castle, do you think she would be free permanently?
See, I wonder if it was tied to placement or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We're about 10 minutes shy of the ending, and we finally get Lee and Cushing acting off each other. But it's a doozy of a scene, so it's worth the wait.
I wish to see Mr. Heights. Will you tell him, please?
I take it that you are Dr. Namroff?
I am.
Come in. My name is Meister, Karl Meister. I've been looking forward to meeting you, Doctor.
I'd like to make this brief, if you don't mind. In the early hours of this morning, a young woman was seen in the grounds of this house.
Indeed.
I have reason to believe she is here now.
Is she a patient of yours, Doctor?
I am responsible for her.
Yeah. Yes, of course, an amnesia victim is a great responsibility.
What did you say?
One never really knows what they're capable of, does one? They might even commit murder during one of their lapses, and no one would be any the wiser.
Meister is totally in control this whole time, which flummoxes Namorov, who has been controlling things for years, but now everything is spinning out of his grasp.
Mm-hmm.
Meister gets a bit reckless, though, himself, when he holds the doctor at knife point.
Yeah. So,
I wonder if you could give this back to Mr. Radoff. He tried to kill Paul with it yesterday. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. he's like, got it in his face. And then my one quibble with this scene, though, is Patrick Troughton's Canoff. You know, it's like, you know, points the gun at him and says, if you don't let go of the professor, I'll be forced to shoot you. He comes down the stairs. He's pointing a gun at everybody. He points it at Peter Cushing. He points it again at Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He points it at his own men. Actors are notoriously bad about pointing guns at people that they don't intend to shoot.
Right.
And my daddy taught me, you don't point a gun at anybody you don't intend to shoot.
Exactly.
Or anything you don't intend to shoot. Target,
exactly.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, that's a common mistake you see a lot in movies. This guy's just waving guns around at their friends or at people they don't intend to shoot.
Right, right. I mean, when you have a gun on something or someone, that's your target.
Expect it to go off.
Yep.
Yeah. I was starting to wonder about the full moon business, but it's really the second night, the actual full moon that Megara usually strikes on. I mean, actually, there's really only one night of a full moon that's completely full.
Full, right.
But, you know, most lycanthropic-type fiction fudges it and says, well, there's three nights, you
yeah.
know. It's like the one before and the one after, you know, account. So, although I have read somewhere that's like, you know, I think in the Jeff Rovin Return of the Wolfman book, on the night of the full moon, like this night, the Wolfman's even more animalistic and more powerful, and he's like, anything that would keep Larry Talbot from killing somebody
mm-hmm.
that he knew is totally gone. He's like completely animalistic in that book. So makes sense. Well, you know, if you're talking about werewolves, it makes sense within werewolf fiction. It's not often in cinema you see a grown man slapped in submission by another that's not their father. But if someone has to do it, get Christopher Lee because he's 6'6" or whatever. And then he sends Paul to his room without his supper, I'd imagine. He's all sulking around, but, oh, my God, he hit me.
Yes. Yeah.
If only Meister had nodded off.
Oh, he fell asleep, dude.
And Paul and Namorov weren't love-struck idiots, too. But,
yeah, sure.
I love how Meister just takes those two cops and throws them aside. He just, like, shoves them into each other. And then
I don't
runs,
have time for this.
Runs up, then he's like, yoink, runs up the stairs. This movie would be even funner if Cushing and Lee both said yoink at different points.
Or they yeeted things.
Yeah. I still haven't seen that movie. There's that movie with, I think it's called One More Time with Sammy Davis Jr. I think it's directed by Jerry Lewis.
Okay.
But it's like some dream sequence or something, and he sees Cushing as Dr. Frankenstein and Christopher Lee as Dracula. They're in the movie with him. And there's these publicity shots with him hanging around with Sammy Davis Jr.
Mm.
I got to watch that movie because, I mean, what the hell is cooler? What the cool trio of people. That's like Sammy Davis Jr., Christopher Lee, and Peter Cushing. That's awesome.
Instead of the Rat Pack, the Bat Pack.
Nice.
You might like that.
Nice, nice. Well, there was that cartoon, the Drac Pack. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The bit where Paul walks past Namorov in the shadows at the castle, that's expertly done. He looks like a part of the scenery until you notice the sword in his hand. And he's like, Carla! And he's like, I'm waiting for Carla, Mr. Heights. And then he, like, swings at him. And then Paul picks a very heavy-looking candelabra to fight with. I mean, Pasco really sells that it's hard to maneuver with.
Right.
But it's probably because it honestly is. It looks heavy.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be one of those cases where it, like, weighs nothing, but it doesn't look that way. And the poster, one of the main posters of this movie, shows the two fighting. And Paul's got the candelabra. And the illustration of his hair looks like he's, like, some punk. Like, he's got punk hair or something because his hair
is all windblown.
It's windblown everywhere, which it never looks that way. It's kind of crazy. And then we see the Gorgon in full close-up for the first time. But let's save all that for the end. We'll talk about that in the end. Instead, let's talk about her power. Both Namoroff and Paul seem to be unable to stop themselves from looking at her despite really trying.
Right.
So I guess if you get in a certain proximity of her, she can just dominate your will. But maybe it's the siren song because somehow the song's still playing even though she's clearly not singing. So I don't know if she's got, you know, an MP3 player.
Maybe she's humming.
She got her phone. She got her humming. Yeah, she's so good. So Meister actually gets to behead her. Of course, you don't see the actual beheading, but you do see the head. And for 1964, it's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
It's there's a bloody stump. You know, it's not, you know, it would be pretty clean with the sword. It's not going to be jagged or anything. So it's not bad. But, you know, what a downer ending. I know.
Everybody dies except one person.
Well, Meister survives and Canoff and Radoff, unfortunately.
Oh, true.
And what's with all the offs in Vandorf? I mean, you got Namoroff, Radoff, Canoff. I'm surprised Meister isn't Meister off and Heitz isn't Heitz off.
Yeah.
So what did you think of the ending?
Again, like we said, nobody was happy.
Yeah. I mean, even poor Professor Meister lost his friend and protege, and apparently he was friends with the Professor Heitz as well.
Mm-hmm.
So both his friends are dead, and he had to kill somebody, so that's probably weighs on his conscience now. So now the big sticking point with this movie has always been the title character. Barbara Shelley lobbied to actually play Megara with heavy makeup and a wig fitted with real garter snakes. She was willing to wear real snakes on her head. But producer Anthony Nelson Keyes thought that that would give away the secret, which is really very obvious.
Uh-huh.
So instead, they outfitted actress Prudence Hyman with a wig full of rubber snakes operated by cables. Now, Hyman went uncredited in several Hammer flicks where she had bit parts such as Rasputin the Mad Monk with Lee and Shelley, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, and The Witches with Joan Fontaine, which was her last film. She was credited in Richard the Lionheart and several TV productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally think the effect works for the most part.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, did you think it, you know, what did you think of it?
I mean, again, you have to figure this was made in 1963, 1964, and for the time, it's fine, you know?
Right. There are a few shots that linger too long for the snake movement to seem mechanical, like it repeats the same movement. And that's where it really kind of falls down, in my opinion. But honestly, the makeup on her face, the red eyes, and the subtle scaly makeup she's got kind of deflects from that.
Yeah.
And she's got this really just awful, just sadistic look on her face, like she's enjoying, you know, that she's about to petrify you, you know. So I think it works. Although Christopher Lee's take on the film has been widely publicized, even on TCM when Ben Mankiewicz hosted the film, he mentioned that Lee said, "The only thing wrong with the Gorgon is the Gorgon."
Wow.
But Christopher Lee was pretty critical of every Hammer movie he was in, really. So, but I don't think the effects are that bad, and the rest of the film is so well done, and the cast is so great. A little FX hinkiness is just part of its charm at this point.
Yeah, and again, it was 63, 64 when this was filmed. Right, you know, so.
Right, exactly. A spiritual sequel of sorts to this was produced and directed by independent filmmaker Joshua Kennedy and released last year. House of the Gorgon stars Hammer alumni Caroline Monroe, Martine Beswick, Veronica Carlson, and Christopher Neame, Johnny Alucard. Definitely worth checking out for classic horror fans. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to the comic crypt for a Medusa-type tale. Stay tuned.
Welcome to this month's meeting of the Classic Horrors Club. I'm Rich Chamberlain from MonsterMovieKid.wordpress.com and KCCinephile.com.
And I'm Jeff Owens from ClassicHorrors.club.
Let's begin with a report from our Sergeant-at-Arms. Vince, are there any housekeeping details today?
Once the door is locked, there's no way out. The windows have bars that a jail would be proud of, and the only door to the outside locks like a vault. There's no electricity, no phone, no one within miles, so no way to call for help.
Thank you for that very thorough report. As you all know... Oh, yes, we have a comment.
It's time we started. We had better get on with it.
Well, we're trying. As you all know, we're recording a new bumper for the podcast. So what testimonials can you give potential listeners? Yes, Al?
I hope that as you listen to this, you are among your loved ones.
Interesting feedback, I guess. Vince, what do you think he means by that?
So many unexplainable things have happened here.
You're not really selling it, guys. Chris, how do you think fans of classic horror, from Silent Scream to Halloween and everything scary in between, will feel after listening to the Classic Horrors Club podcast?
In the first moments, every muscle, every fiber will be afire with torment and agony. In the days to come, you will pray for death.
Come on, doesn't anyone have something good to say about the Classic Horrors Club podcast? Yes, Bela.
Well, this isn't a very pleasant way to entertain a guest.
At least someone's having fun. Let's adjourn on a high note. Al, would you like to sign us out?
This concludes our danse macabre.
Eloquent as usual. Thank you.
Please join us for the next monthly episode of the Classic Horrors Club podcast, available where all fine podcasts are found.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The year is 1994, or 1944, or maybe 2994. Time is under threat, and history is falling apart. Who will survive this crisis, and how will history be changed for those that do? Zero Hour Strikes takes you back to that DC Comics crossover and covers the entire story, issue by issue, tie-in by tie-in, as the DC Universe goes down to zero. Join Bass and Siskoid at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on iTunes, Zero Hour Strikes, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Remember Legion.
Okay, we're back, and we've broken into the comic crypt in the House of Frankenstein once more to discuss a monstrous back issue. Hawkman number 25 was cover dated April-May 1968, on sale February 15th, 1968. Did someone say Hawkman?
Oh, crap, it's that pervy gentleman ghost.
So you're finally covering another story featuring yours truly. Splendid. Sorry, Gentleman Jim, this Hawkman issue doesn't feature you. It ties into our movie, so it features a Gorgon. A what?
A Gorgon. A snake-haired lady? Not you. Now, scram.
Why the gall of you two? You cover a book with my arch-nemesis, and you don't even pick one with me in it? Sorry, we didn't cover a ghost story or a headless character this time. Besides, are you a Hawkman villain or a Batman villain? Well, I'm considered both, actually. But among Hawkman villains, I'm number one. I have to compete with too many other ne'er-do-wells over in Gotham.
Well, this isn't a Batman comic with you either, so poof away or whatever you do.
Fine. Enjoy your comic, but just wait until you get to my appearances on your JLU cast. You've got yourself a guest host. Or a guest ghost. Joke's on him. The Gentleman Ghost doesn't show up until the last season of JLU. It'll take us years to get there. Anyway, back to Hawkman number 25. The cover by Dick Dillon and Charles Quadera depicts the large figure of a green woman with stringy, snake-like hair rising from flames. She commands living fire creatures to attack a seemingly defeated Hawkman. The cover blurb reads, "Return of the Death Goddess." So what did you think of the cover?
Oh, I think it's cool. I mean, you know, it'd be a cool poster.
Yeah. This is pretty striking. The Death Goddess is kind of sexy looking too, actually.
Yeah.
He's got like a fire bustier. So it looks like a female Super Skrull that's part Human Torch, part She-Hulk.
Oh, I can see that.
And I like the purple background too. That's a nice choice. So. Of course, She-Hulk wasn't in the Fantastic Four in 1968, but you know, hey, it works. Return of the Death Goddess was written by Bob Zaney Haney. So you're in for a good time. Mm. Pencils by Dick Dillon, inks by Chuck Quadera, edited by George Kashtan.
Sentinel of the skies, winged phantom of the night, the Hawkman fights the evils of the present with the weapons of the past.
After a very spoil-filled splash page we'll get to later, our story begins with Midway City abuzz about the latest and greatest exhibit at its city museum. Blind archaeologist Professor Martin has unearthed a long-lost statue of Medusa and brought it to Midway first as a favor to his friend, curator Carter Hall. When the press asks Martin how he found the statue, he admits he leads a lonely existence, and Medusa so occupied his mind and dreams over the years, he felt her call to him until he found her. Martin is shocked to hear the patrons of the museum call the snake-haired statue hideous and evil, since he believes Medusa had to be good, having meant so much to him over the years.
Co-curator Shiera Hall is impressed at the speed Martin is reading and transcribing the ancient stone tablet found buried with the statue. Martin continues to work on the transcription late in the night until he cracks the code. "Let not this form again draw breath, return from death, but if you would loose the stone that grips, mortal kiss Medusa's lips."
Martin briefly scoffs at the notion that this could revive Medusa, but since he's apparently really obsessed and very lonely, I'm sorry, check out Tinder, dude. He decides, what the hell? He kisses the stone statue and the stone of Medusa rises. Unbeknownst to Martin, her thoughts are all about revenge on humankind for turning her to stone, but she decides to let her rescuer live. She thanks him and bestows her love, but asks him to promise her if she's ever in trouble to once again kiss the lips of her statue. Martin is overjoyed that he's found love and will never be lonely again, while Medusa sets out to find a host body so she can go about her campaign of vengeance.
The first body she finds is none other than Shiera Hall. So of course Medusa hops in and takes the red-haired Thanagarian for a test drive. Shiera's personality is almost instantly dominated as Medusa flies her body, sans Shiera's usual wings and nth metal anti-gravity belt, out of the museum and high into the sky. There she conjures up a fire demon and sends it toward the Harris Blasting Powder Company plant. The resulting explosion literally sets the city on fire.
Carter Hall instantly goes into action as Hawkman, unaware his wife and crime-fighting partner are already mixed up in the disaster. Saving a group of people from a burning building, he notices the flying figure of a woman in the distance but doesn't recognize her. He doesn't have time to follow since the fire continues to spread. With apparently no other options, where's that JLA communicator, Carter? Hawkman uses a pair of Thanagarian electro-knuckles to plow through the nearby dam, flooding the town and dousing the inferno.
Medusa is none too happy her bonfire has been rained out, so she frees all the animals from the Midway City Zoo. Of course, the animals go about attacking everyone they see, so Hawkman kicks a tiger into the river and slaps a bear silly with a wrecking ball. He wrestles yet another tiger, while the army arrives to face Medusa, now standing defiantly in the city streets. Shiera's red hair is now wild and tendril-like, her face growing angry and ugly. The sorceress conjures a giant minotaur whose strength and fire breath destroy the army's tanks. When foot soldiers approach Medusa, they are all turned to stone. Hey, remember she actually turns people to stone.
Mm.
An airstrike proves no more useful as Medusa conjures up a hurricane that rips the jets to shreds, forcing their pilots to parachute like a G.I. Joe cartoon. Hawkman pursues the flying woman chasing after another jet and closing in realizes he's after his own wife.
It doesn't take long for him to figure out Shiera isn't home right now, since she doesn't recognize him and instantly tries to choke him to death. Surmising it's Medusa, he begins to battle her in the sky while the citizens below and the media take note. Professor Martin hears of the battle over the radio and is distressed to learn that his beloved Medusa is about to be defeated. He remembers what she said to him earlier and kisses the statue once more. Medusa is recharged in the heat of battle and conjures up an ice prison around Hawkman. He plummets to the ground, but the impact shatters the ice, freeing him.
He lands near the museum and, realizing all the horror started here, races inside. Despite the protest of the love-struck Professor Martin, Hoffman shoves the statue over, smashing it to pieces. In the skies above, Medusa screams in pain as her powers vanish. Hoffman flies outside just in time to catch Shiera's falling body. Hoffman watches as the long, tendril hair and twisted face revert to the lovely form of his wife, while Professor Martin weeps, cradling the head of his shattered, lost love. So what did you think of this one?
Oh.
It's zany.
Uh-huh. And she's Medusa with no snakes in her hair. Her hair, she looks like the chick from the Inhumans.
Like that Medusa.
Yeah.
She does kind of look like that Medusa.
Yeah.
Good point. I have to thank Mike's Amazing World once more for this one. I wasn't really aware of a Medusa-like monster in any superhero comics. Sure, there was the Inhuman Medusa, like you said, and the Medusa character in the Creature Commandos, but they are both eventually protagonists. I thought about doing that story where Batgirl gets turned into a snake person by that other, like, half-snake lady, but she's like a snake on her bottom, not her top. So that was kind of pushing it. So I typed in Medusa into Mike's Amazing World, and this one came up. And then I read the synopsis and how she possesses Shiera, and it was just too perfect not to cover.
Right.
Yeah. So a little background info. The Silver Age Hawkman feature had been edited by Julius Schwartz since it began in the Brave and the Bold number 34, February-March 1961. When Hawkman finally got his own book in 1964, Schwartz was at the helm. Most stories were written by Hawkman co-creator Gardner Fox and penciled by Murphy Anderson. Some editorial changes were made at DC in the late 60s, and with issue number 22, the Hawkman title shifted over to editor George Kasdan. He brought along the same team currently working on his Blackhawk title, writer Bob Haney, longtime Blackhawk penciler Dick Dillon, and Blackhawk co-creator Chuck Quadera. The Blackhawks were in their infamous Junk Heap Heroes phase, where they adopted superhero disguises, and this team brought a similar shakeup to Hawkman with their first issue. Carter and Shiera Hall are outed as aliens, but they manage to convince the world they aren't Hawkman and Hawkgirl, but they are still known as aliens.
Okay.
This run, which goes through issue 27, is widely regarded by Hawkman fans as non-canon or taking place on a parallel Earth other than Earth 1. In fact, that's even mentioned in the network's friend Doug Zawisha's Hawkman companion from Tomorrow's. Murray Boltanoff took over the editorial reins with issue number 26, so I guess we can assign these to Earth B, where many of his Brave and the Bold issues, written by Bob Haney, are said to have taken place. Hawkman is canceled with their last issue, and then squats in his pal the Atom's title for a bit, when it becomes the Atom and the Hawkman, as we covered a few years back, when we did bring the Gentleman Ghost onto the show. The stories are again edited by Julius Schwartz, and all this alien reveal business is largely discarded. Heck, it's not even mentioned here. So, but Julius Schwartz also gave us Mopey in The Flash. So, He's not innocent in these type of things. But back to the story, we talked about the splash. As often was the case from the Golden through the Silver Age, splash pages often gave away story beats probably best left for the interior.
Mm-hmm.
We see the Medusa-influenced Shiera floating before a Hawkman who is encased in the ice prison. And he's basically like, it looks like my wife, but she's got the powers of Medusa or something. So, Professor Martin, what'd you think about that guy?
Oh, bless it. He needs to look up Tinder, Grindr, or something, you know, pay an escort. Bless it.
You have some friends set you up, sign up for a dating service, something. I mean, how hard up do you have to be to fall in love with a Gorgon? I mean, and if he knows so much about her, how can he completely deny her?
That's the thing. I mean, you know,
the legend of her being
she was
evil.
A good person.
Legend. Yeah, it's like, you know, and clearly they're not following the actual legend, or she'd be beheaded per the movie and Clash of the Titans. Of course, that's, you know, that's the original. Yeah, you know, so I do think his line about how she filled my waking hours, walked through my dreams, may seem to indicate she was somehow controlling him to love her, but when he revives her, she doesn't seem overly familiar with him.
See, it would have made more sense if it did, if she had been.
Yeah.
I mean, if they had said, oh, he's come along nicely, you know, I've got him under my power, you know,
I've been manipulating him for years. Yeah.
Yeah.
How can they say the lady with snakes for hair is hideous, love what you love, dude, but geez, you know.
You do you, honey.
So the incantation, I often wonder, why do these ancient people who imprison these monsters leave return to factory setting instructions? I mean, you know, why would you ever think someone would want this thing loosed upon the world again?
The JLU released Lex Luthor when they had a use for him. Just saying.
That's true. In our last episode, that's true.
Yeah.
I'm just glad this was the Silver Age, because as hard up as Martin is for the statue, modern writers would have probably gone someplace even nastier than him just kissing it.
Ew, okay. Moving on.
Yeah. Dylan and Quidera give Medusa snake hair, but the snakes are kind of minimalist. They're just snake heads at the end of wild and crazy hair tendrils, really. I mean, they don't look overly snaky.
Well, and when Shiera is possessed, they're not snakes at all.
Yeah.
It's just wild hair.
Yeah. So, of course, Medusa finds Shiera, who is still working in the museum. What did you think about her outfit? I mean, the white blouse and blue-black capris with a red belt. I thought she looked kind of classy but hot.
Yeah,
it was a nice look for her, I thought. Yeah. Before she started all looking, you know, weird Medusa looking, you know, harsh. But so this fire demon is pretty impressive. It's just one demon, unlike the cover. But Dylan gives us a page-long panel to reveal it.
Yeah.
But since when can Medusa summon up fire demons?
I know. I mean,
and is a sorceress. Well,
I don't know. I mean,
there's plenty to go on in the actual legend of Medusa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
it's like they got confused about what the powers of Circe was versus the powers of what Medusa was and combined them.
I mean, imagine that somehow Medusa had been turned to a statue and this guy sets her free somehow. And, you know, at the museum, there's all these stone statues. Mm-hmm. What if all of a sudden there's all of a sudden additional statues and people are like, where are these statues coming from? And at first people are like, you know, well, where'd this statue come from? Why do we have a statue of a guard they recognize a guard, but somebody, and then it's all of a sudden, like, she's, like, literally in the museum, like turning people into stone or something, you know? I mean, and Hawkman could have used an ancient shield like Perseus.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he could have basically been Perseus,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he usually uses ancient weapons from Earth
mm-hmm.
in his stories, which is another thing they didn't get right when these new guys took over. So that's why we get Hawkman with Thanagarian Electro Knuckles. But I do think that Dick Dillon and Quidera do a good job of, you know, in a Silver Age way, showing that the whole town's on fire. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a code-approved comic in the Silver Age. It's not going to get gruesome. But I think it really does seem like the whole town's on fire. But yeah, we get the Thanagarian Electro Knuckles, and, you know, I don't know about that. I mean, we've seen what flood damage can do.
Yes. I mean,
how's that better than a fire?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he literally flooded the entire city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. It seemed like
our town was flooded in 97. I mean,
yeah. I mean, just think about, you know, the different hurricanes that have hit. And I mean, good Lord, like Katrina and things. I mean, you know, think about it just, you know. And I know maybe it wasn't as wide, the knowledge of flood damage wasn't as widespread back then because you didn't have 24-hour news all the time. But at the same time, it's like, that's a pretty extreme solution. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like he could have come up with something else. Those Electro Knuckles, I don't care how powerful they are, he put his fist through a stone dam,
mm-hmm.
a concrete dam. I mean, that, unless it's got some kind of force field around it, you know, it doesn't look like it. It looks like he literally punched through a dam. Like, the ends of his arms would be bloody stumps.
Yeah.
You know, I would think. So then she lets loose all the animals at the zoo. And of course, the first thing they do is just attack everyone.
I know.
Because that's what animals do. You know, it's like, yeah. Now, when Hawkman.
I felt so bad for the bear. He got hit with a ball.
A wrecking ball.
Oh, I mean, I felt bad for him.
Now, Hawkman went all Miley Cyrus on him. Now, they do show that animal handlers are coming to get the tiger that he kicks in the river, but I'm pretty sure that the bear, the bear's going to survive that.
No,
yeah.
I'm not happy about that.
Yeah, Zany Haney's going nuts with this, and Dylan and Quidera are too. They're now drawing Medusa with long, wild hair everywhere. Like you said, she kind of looks like the Marvel Medusa, and there's some extreme perspective shots as she conjures up a giant minotaur who can also breathe fire. I mean, honestly, this seems like the kind of stuff me and my friends would cook up for play with our action figures. Mm-hmm. Like, if you brought in a toy from other lines and gave them the same amount of powers. Like, and now the G.I. Joes have to fight this giant green tiger who isn't Battle Cat but can breathe fire and fly. And, you know, he can also transport and, you know, and all this, you know, just like it's just, he can do all this stuff. It's like I said, there's plenty of legend for Amy to go on without making stuff up. But, we don't actually see her in the shot, but the soldiers approach Medusa and she turns them to stone, which is Medusa's actual shtick. But the colorist lets us down by not coloring these.
I know! I'm like, what?
They're not gray.
Yeah.
They don't look like they're stone. And there's not a whole lot of pitted, like, stone, like, texture inked on them. And so they look like soldiers still standing there. The dialogue tells us they're stone. But then she whips up a hurricane that rips up jets. And how did they defeat her centuries ago if she's this powerful?
Exactly.
You know, exactly. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the wizard Shazam defeated her or something. I don't know. So now Hawkman realizes his wife is behind all this, although he quickly deduces Medusa has possessed her. But, you know, I wish they had given her snake hair.
No snakes. But the thing is they mention in, like, the news is talking about that there's a woman with snake hair. And I'm like, no, she doesn't have snake hair. It's just wild. She needs a good brush.
Yeah, I think they kind of goofed on not giving her full-on snake hair. Yeah. I mean, she should have.
He even says that.
She should have, by the end, looked like a red hair. She should have had red snake hair to still look somewhat like Shara, but also look like Medusa. Yeah. Yeah. So, it's worth noting that they misspell Shara's name throughout this issue, her Earth name. They give it an extra R. It's supposed to just have one, and they give it two, which is another thing these guys didn't. I mean, they clearly didn't know Hawkman and were, you know, doing Hawkman's book. We don't see Hawkman winning against Medusa. We just see the crowd reacting and hear the read the radio broadcast, which show don't tell people. You know, let's see it. You know? But that way, Professor Martin hears it on the radio, and he is one self-absorbed nut. He's not worrying about all the destruction this woman's causing.
No.
He's in love with her, so he's going to kiss her again. So, not unlike Namoroth and Paul.
Right.
Especially Namoroth, who knew what she was and kept letting her loose every month. Radoff following her isn't working, dude. Seven people got killed before this movie started.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
He is obviously asleep on the job.
Yes. So she freezes Hawkman in ice, and somehow it saves him when he falls. Wouldn't all that jagged ice have been painful to fall upon?
One would think.
You'd think so, yeah. Conveniently falls right outside the museum, where he works, of course. We're running out of pages here, people, so we got to wrap this up.
Oh, yeah.
So over Martin's protest, he just shoves the statue over into a wall, apparently, and she shatters. And it's kind of a tiny panel, considering it's the big save action beat, so the next panel of Medusa reacting to her losing her powers is huge. I think I would have swapped that. I think I would have had a big kapow moment of the statue shattering. You know?
Yeah.
Big, huge panel. But, I mean, I love Dick Dillon, but I'm just saying, yeah. The last page must have had an ad because it's only a half page of two panels. A close-up of Shira as Hawkman declares she's back to normal and Medusa is dead. And we never even hear her speak here. So, and then that final panel of Martin cradling the head of Medusa, you have to wonder, did he try to glue her back together? I mean,
did he try and bring her back? Did he take her home for some kind of illicit ew?
Oh.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, this guy is totally off his rocker at this point. I don't think this guy's coming back from this. I think he's got far gone. And Carter Hall needs some better friends. I'm sorry. So despite the bat crap crazy places this story goes, I did have fun reading it. The art's a bit different. It's nice, but different. It doesn't quite look like a Silver Age DC comic to me. That's possibly because Dillon and Quadera both came from Quality Comics. They worked on Black Hawk there, and it got bought. Quality got bought out by DC, and Black Hawk just continued on the next month under DC, and they had been drawing it for a decade or more at this point. So they just kind of had a different look. Of course, in a few months, Dillon would begin his long run on Justice League of America, and the inkers there would kind of give his art a more DC look. His art would evolve over time, picking up influence of Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, perfecting that Bronze Age DC house style. Now, this story is by Bob Zaney Haney, as we said, so it's pretty crazy, but man, it is jam-packed.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of action, lots of story beats you didn't expect come out of nowhere, other than the strange direction of making Medusa an all-powerful sorceress and almost forgetting her whole turn-to-stone power. I wish Shire was more than just a pawn in this story, though.
Right. I mean, she just gets taken over, no problem.
Yeah, and, you know, such was the fate of many women in comics at the time, but it's especially galling since this is Hawk Girl, and we know our Justice League animated Hawk Girl is not one to play the victim here.
Mm-mm.
I mean, she would have fought it and went in and grabbed Hawkman's mace from him and smashed the statue herself.
Yep.
You know, and that would have been a lot more, you know, get out of my head or something, and then like smack the statue and destroyed it. That would have been cool. But this is 1968.
Well, you got to think this. He smashed it while she was in the air.
Right.
How was he to know he was going to be able to get back there in time to catch her?
Exactly. And she ain't got her anti-gravity belt.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she didn't have ice to cushion her fall.
That's right. this comic is on the DC Universe app if you want to read it. And it's also reprinted in the Showcase Presents Hawkman Volume 2, although those are getting harder and harder to find. Although, I guess Ollie's had a bunch of them, but I think
you had it, didn't you? I've got
Volume 1. Mm. I don't think I got Volume. I never saw Volume 2. But.
Okay.
Well, that'll do it for this trip to the House of Frankenstein. Thanks, as always, to all our patrons who support the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo and Matt Ryan for specifically supporting our JLU cast. Like last month, we're thanking them here until we get back to JLU cast. Sorry our Hawk Girl content didn't quite match up to what you were used to there, fellas, but what can we do?
But, you know, they get to hear me, so, you know.
Exactly.
That's all good.
Go to patreon.com/FW podcast to see the many ways you can help support the network and all the shows here. Special thanks to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. War Hill Terry, for the House of Frankenstein theme. Terry's band, Stop Calling Me Frank, has a new album out called Haberdash. Check out the show notes for a link on how you can check it out. Come back in 2 weeks for another trip to the House of Frankenstein. We'll give you a hint. We're visiting with another son of a famous monster. See you then.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide and is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
All the dates when the amnesia occurred and reoccurred.
Then you seriously believe it? You seriously suspect that Carla
is... Why shouldn't I? I'm not in love with her.
Oh, you're mad!